The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last few weeks, I've been talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. And I've been starting each evening with a little bit of an overview, a little bit of a review. And tonight I thought I'd start that review by pointing to the problem that the Buddha was essentially trying to address with this path, which is the problem of what is often translated as suffering. And the term dukkha is often translated as suffering. But that term, dukkha, which is essentially the problem that the Buddha saw, that when he looked at humanity and saw essentially that people were struggling, dissatisfied, unhappy, frustrated, unable to really find a kind of a lasting happiness, always trying to grasp after something that would make them happy and continually having it slip through their fingers. So this is essentially what the Buddha was trying to address, this problem of living and the way that we just continually find a sense of unhappiness, of unease, of, and even if it's not real strong suffering or strong unhappiness, there's often a sense of just like, isn't there something more, or what's wrong with me, or why can't this work out the way I'd like it to? That there's almost always a little bit of a dissonance with things as they are. Either we're trying to hold on to things and keep them, and then they just disappear, or we're trying to push things away that we don't like. So in this problem, in this, you know, essentially this illness, you could look at it, that the Buddha was trying to address in the human condition, he saw that there were some specific things that we could do, a specific direction we could take to live our lives in a different way. And this is the Noble Eightfold Path. And it starts with basically needing to understand what this dukkha is. What is this dissatisfaction? What is this unease, this distress? Tanjeff translates the term suffering simply as stress, which gives a sense of how subtle it can be. You know, we all have a sense of stress in our lives. It doesn't have to be full-blown suffering. So the first steps of the Eightfold Path are just the beginning of understanding what this stress is, how it comes to be. And initially, this is the first two aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding and wise intention. And initially, this understanding is more of an intellectual understanding. And it may be a little bit of inspiration that we see certain people or hear certain teachings that inspire us to think there may be a possibility to live my life in a different way. And so that little bit of understanding about how stress comes to be and what it actually is. Begins to encourage us, inspire us to start engaging in practices. The next set of practices that are suggested in the Eightfold Path is the practice of ethics, which is basically harmonizing our relationship in the world. So this practice of the Eightfold Path isn't simply about sitting down and closing our eyes. It really begins with this cultivation of harmonious relationships with other people, with ourselves, and with the world. This is the three aspects of the Eightfold Path: wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. So having understood a little bit about how suffering comes to be, and with the intention to follow the practices, those are the first two aspects of the Eightfold Path, we start engaging in these more worldly aspects of our life, getting our life, the kind of interactions of our life, to fit into peacefulness, harmoniousness, non-harming. And then moving on from there, the last aspect, the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path are what might be called mental cultivation, mental development. And these three are wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Now, why would mental cultivation be part of this path? Essentially, this connects back with what the understanding is about how this stress comes to be. When we look at this, when we start to understand how this suffering, this dissatisfaction, this stress, this unease comes to be in our lives, we see that largely it happens because we are either resisting the way things are or trying to hold on to the way things are. That either there's something that's pleasant that we like and we want to hold on to it and keep it for good, thinking things are good right now, I'm going to just try to keep it this way. And in that effort of trying to keep it in a particular way, we suffer because things don't stay in a particular way. They are continually changing. So something, if we construct our world, we arrange our lives in a particular way, and finally we've got everything for just a moment where it's just, yes, this is right. A few moments later, something has changed. Very often, things out of our control. Or we are continually dissatisfied with the things as they are right now, and we're trying to fix them, control them, change them. We're trying to find the way to arrange things such that we'll be happy. This is putting our happiness out into the world, essentially. We are trying to pin our hopes for happiness on arranging things outside of us. And when we look at the processes that are going on around the dissatisfaction, we see that they are processes in our own minds. So the resistance to things as they are is a process that's happening in our own minds. The wanting to hold on to things, that wanting is a process that's happening in our minds. So essentially, when the Buddha looked at this human condition, he saw that the vast majority of what we struggle with is created by our own minds. Hence the need for mental development, to look at our minds, to understand how our minds are working. Typically, our minds are scattered. They are jumping around, trying to figure out what's going to make us happy in the world out there, trying to arrange the world out there. It's kind of like fragmented. Our thoughts jump all over the place, trying to figure out what will make us happy. We're propelled by mental habits and reactivity, emotional reactivity, that seems to feed on not being aware of it. That these patterns, these habits that we continually act out of, mostly we seem to be at the mercy of those habits and not particularly in control of our own minds. So this mental cultivation begins to bring our minds into some settledness, these three aspects of wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration work together. And this is, in fact, I think what Tanjeff is going to talk about this weekend. He's going to talk about these three aspects and how they really work together to support this mental cultivation. So the effort to stay connected with experience, the effort to be mindful, those two pieces, the effort to stay connected to what is happening in the present moment, and also to, in particular, use some of that understanding, that wisdom of what is helpful for letting go of suffering and what leads us to suffering. So that's the cultivation of wise effort and wise mindfulness together, those two. And the bringing of those two together, that as we bring our energy directed to being present moment after moment, it cultivates concentration. That this sustaining of mindfulness over time is what cultivates concentration, a stabilizing, a settling of the mind. So we make the effort to sustain our attention, our mindfulness, we make the effort to sustain the mindfulness, and that results in concentration. So these three aspects together help to settle this distracted, jumpy mind, help us to be able to settle that emotional reactivity, settle those habits down, those kind of patterns that we habitually act out of, so that we're no longer, we have the opportunity more to see things as they are, rather than being resistant to things as they are, or trying to hold on to things. So these three qualities work together. And tonight, since I talked about wise effort and wise mindfulness in the last few weeks, I'm going to focus on wise concentration. So concentration is, it's described as a kind of a mental unification, that the mind kind of collects together, all the parts of the mind come together to act together towards a purpose. So all of those scattered agendas that we have and habitual patterns that are operating, the scattered, distracted way that our mind tends to normally function, that settles down and becomes unified, collected, concentrated. Gill sometimes uses the word composed, and he likes this word, and I particularly like this word too. The word that is translated as concentration often is the term samadhi. And the term concentration to many of us has a kind of a narrowing definition. We tend to think of concentration as being narrow the focus, bring it to just this one thing. The term samadhi is broader than that. It is this unification of mind, but it doesn't have to be completely just focused or narrowed. The mind doesn't need to get narrowed in concentration. In fact, it can be very spacious. The term samadhi in Pali, there's two parts to that word. The sam part, which means with, and the adi part, which means something like to stand, foundation, to stand. So samadhi means something, the literal translation means something like to stand with. And the term compose has a similar root. Kam means with, and pose has the sense of stand. So the term compose actually has a nice connection to the actual Pali in terms of the way the word is the roots of the word. And it has a similar feeling, this composure. When the mind is concentrated, it's composed. It's unified. So when we're concentrated, there's not this sense of the mind being scattered and multitasking and trying to figure out all the things that we're trying to do. It's unified, it's gathered, it's directed towards a purpose. There's some qualities of a concentrated mind. The concentrated mind tends to have this unbroken attentiveness. As I was saying, that the concentration is this stability or continuity of awareness. So there's that unbroken attentiveness is a hallmark of the concentration. And there's a sense of tranquility. The mind really settles down. It's no longer agitated. Kind of the normal way that our minds are, jumping around from thing to thing, there's an inherent kind of agitation, a disturbance to the mind. And when the mind is concentrated, it's no longer disturbed. It's no longer agitated. So there's a sense of tranquility. So there are two kinds of concentration, really. So I'd like to talk about both of them. There's a kind of a one-pointed concentration, which is this focusing, you know, that you can become concentrated by focusing on one thing. And there is what's called moment-to-moment concentration, which is more about a continuity of awareness than a continuity of the thing that we are aware of. So the first kind of concentration, I'm going to talk about both of them, and I'm just going to briefly describe these two. This first kind of concentration is, generally it's cultivated with the practice of settling the mind on one thing. So the breath or a mantra. There's many things that can be used as a focus for concentration. And we use that as a tool to steady the mind. That when we notice that our mind has slipped off, we come back. We come back to that thing. So with this kind of just coming back over and over and over again, the mind becomes relaxed, it becomes calm, it becomes stable. It becomes tranquil. It becomes really happy. It feels pretty good to have this stability of mind settling on this one thing. The moment-to-moment awareness, the moment-to-moment concentration, is a practice of cultivating a stability of awareness rather than trying to settle the mind on one thing. So instead of trying to keep everything at bay by just focusing on one thing, instead we are taking in the stream of experience and trying to stay aware in that stream, in that flow. So both of these two types of concentration tend to be cultivated by different types of meditation practices. And I'll talk just briefly about these. But most forms of meditation use both. I think actually all forms of meditation use both concentration and mindfulness. But they emphasize one more than the other. In a sense, it's kind of where the emphasis lies on which you are strengthening. So the one-pointed concentration is really focused on the concentration quality, that focused really on encouraging the mind to settle down as quickly as possible. through this choosing an object, choosing something to pay attention to, and essentially using the mindfulness to recognize when the mind has slipped off of that thing. So the breath, for instance. The breath is a pretty suitable object for most people in meditation. So I'll just use the breath as the example here. It doesn't have to be the breath. It could be a mental image of a color, or it could be an image of a candle flame, or it might be a mantra that you're saying to yourself, or perhaps stabilizing on the sound, the inner sound in the ear, just the kind of high-pitched tone in the ear. It could be many things that we use as a focus point for concentration. The breath is a particularly helpful one because it's always with us. It's easy to access this this object, this experience of the breath. So to settle and collect the mind, how does this paying attention to the breathing? What we do with this kind of meditation is that we use our concentration to try to stay with the breathing, and the mindfulness is what lets us know when we have slipped off the breathing. So the mindfulness can be pretty simple. We don't have to get very detailed about what we're aware of. It's just breath, not breath. That's about all we need to know. When we notice not breath, we bring our attention back to the breath just over and over and over and over again. So we just basically are letting go and letting go, letting go. Actually, concentration is really a practice of letting go. It actually works better if in this cultivating of the stability on the breathing, that we're not trying to hold to the breathing. But rather what our emphasis is on letting go of things that are not the breathing. Just letting go, letting go, letting go. As we just continue to let go, the mind tends to settle and stabilize more on the breathing. So rather than forcing with a concentration, it's not so helpful to try to force the mind, at least in my experience, it's not so helpful to try to force the mind to stay with something. But rather, when noticing we're not with the breathing, just that letting go. Oh, don't need to do that. Just the breathing. Just let go, let go, let go. So we let go of everything. We let go of distracting thoughts. We let go of emotions. We let go of sounds. We let go of other body sensations. Everything. We just let go and just come back to the sensation of the breathing. As we do this, as we practice this, what happens, and this is completely normal experience when we start to bring our attention to this, to try to let go of things, not the breath, and bring our attention to the breath, what happens is that there are these five mental qualities that kind of obstruct concentration. And these are known as the five hindrances. And these are likely to arise as we work to settle the mind, as we make the effort to stay connected with the breathing and let go of things. These hindrances will arise. These are the hindrances of sense desire, of wanting pleasant experience. There's the hindrance of ill will, of not liking what's happening, of wanting that ill will around wanting to manipulate, to control. There is dullness, sleepiness that happens as the mind settles. It can get kind of slothful if there's not enough energy. Or sometimes there's too much energy and restlessness appears, this restlessness, this kind of anxiety and restlessness, both mental and physical. And then there's doubt. There's a doubt around, can I do this? I can't do this very well. Other people seem to be able to do this. There's doubt about the teachings. What does this have to do with anything? He taught 2,500 years ago. How can this possibly relate to me now? There's doubt about the teachers. So these hindrances are very common. they tend to arise in our meditation. And I'm not going to go into detail with them here. Just briefly, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we work to let them go. Because in concentration practice, that is the movement. We notice the hindrances, and we try to let them go. So the first path, the first kind of instruction around working with these hindrances when we're doing a concentration practice is to see if you can simply kind of ignore them, in effect. You know, it's like, that's not what we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to the breath. So, you know, can you just allow them to go to the side and just come back? That's not always possible. But as the mind does start to settle, it actually becomes more and more possible. I remember doing one month-long retreat where I was using loving-kindness as my focus for concentration. So I was doing a concentration practice on the loving-kindness. And I'd primarily done mindfulness practice before that. And my habitual way, my normal way of working with hindrances was to turn mindfulness to them. And I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. You know, to turn my mindful attention to the feeling of ill will or the feeling of desire. And over time with the practice of concentration, the mind got settled and stable enough that it would notice that these hindrances were arising and be kind of like, oh yeah, there's that hindrance. I don't need to worry about that. I just come back to the metta. So it could just be a kind of ignoring. I didn't have to turn my attention to it, to try to do anything with it. I could just bring my attention back to the metta, and the hindrances would subside because they were being let go of through kind of abandoning them. So that's one way to work with these hindrances. Now, it's not. Often we find if we try to ignore our hindrances, if we try to ignore ill will or sense desire, then they're kind of just knocking on the door. You know, they kind of keep going, oh, but I really want that. Oh, I really want that. When you find that that happens, then you need to do something a little more active than that ignoring. You need to take in... you need to work with them a little more directly. And there's two main ways to work with these hindrances. You can, rather than just coming back to the main object of paying attention to the breathing, we need to turn towards the hindrance, either in the way to settle the mind with the kind of using what might be called the antidote to the hindrance. So, for instance, with ill will, the antidote is said to be kindness, loving kindness. Or with sense desire, the antidote is said to contemplate impermanence. So we can, instead of paying attention to the breath, when we notice a particular hindrance coming up, turn our attention to another theme, essentially, another theme of meditation to help let that hindrance settle, to kind of more directly counteract that hindrance. And then there is the way of using direct mindful attention to the hindrance, to actually turn our awareness directly towards the hindrance. So when sleepiness arises, the way if we're using the way of settling the mind through an alternative mode of meditation, we would probably try to actively add energy to the system, either through looking at light or to stand up, to maybe do some walking meditation or reflect on death. Any of those things would bring energy to the mind. With using mindfulness, what we would do instead would be to turn the mind to notice, well, what does it feel like to be sleepy? What's the experience of sleepiness? And that becomes then the way of attending to that hindrance. Now, the hindrances tend to be distracting because they tend to get us into our thoughts. They, you know, Well, sleepiness, actually, we can just go to sleep. But with sense desire, with ill will, we tend to go into our thoughts around those things. With restlessness, often there's a lot of thinking that goes on. And so turning the attention directly to the experience of the hindrance tends to cut the thinking around the hindrance, which is a huge part of how it helps to settle the mind. With the with sleepiness, for instance, if we are turning our attention to the experience of sleepiness, just the simple act of paying attention to the sleepiness can bring energy into the system. So there are ways to be mindful of all of these hindrances. With doubt, doubt actually is mostly about thought. So if you can just turn your attention to anything in your present moment experience and hold on to it a little bit, that supports the letting go of the doubt. And that brings me to five other qualities that start to happen as we settle in our concentration practice. So we cultivate our concentration through trying to stay with the experience of breathing. We cultivate our concentration through letting go of anything not breathing, by abandoning the hindrances, by actively letting go of them, bringing our attention to them if necessary, which supports their settling. And as we do that, as we engage in that concentration practice, there are five factors of concentration that start to arise. And these factors, as they strengthen, these factors also directly counter these hindrances. So these five factors are the aiming of the mind, the directing of the mind to a particular object of meditation. It's called initial application of mind. The term in Pali is vitakka. Then there's the sustaining the connection of the mind. That is the Pali term is vichara. So those are the first two, initial application of mind and sustaining the attention on an object. The third is rapture, that as we begin to connect and sustain, as the mind begins to connect and hold on to an object over time, the mind and body start to get really happy. There's delight and joy and interest in the thing that we're paying attention to. It sounds, you know, if you haven't done a lot of work with the breath, that sounds like, how could you get really delighted and interested in the breath? But it can happen that as we, as the mind settles into that thing, it gets really interested, joyful, and happy to be paying attention to that experience. Then there, the fourth quality is happiness, which is basically the pleasant feeling that accompanies concentration. And this reminds me, there's a kind of, maybe kind of hard to know the distinction just at first description between rapture and happiness. And the commentaries give a simile to help clarify kind of in your mind what the distinction might be. And they say that the simile is that the quality of rapture is like the delight and joy of somebody who's wandering through a desert and sees in a distance an oasis, that they know there is water and shade coming. You know, the kind of energy that arouses, the interest, the joy, the delight that it arouses to realize, I won't have to be wandering here for much longer. Happiness is said to be like that same traveler who has reached the oasis, has taken the water, and is relaxing in the shade. So you can kind of sense a kind of a more peacefulness to the quality of happiness. The quality of rapture, of joy, of rapture has a little more agitation to it. And it's got a little more excitement to it. And then to clarify the distinction between the first two, the initial application of mind, the aiming of the attention at something, and the sustaining the attention over time, the simile that they give around that one is that the initial application, the aiming of the mind, is like a striker hitting the bell. And the sustaining is like the resonance, the sustained ringing of the bell. The fifth quality that is cultivated as we settle into the concentration is this kind of the unification of mind. It's called one-pointed attention. And it doesn't have to be that it is one-pointed only on one thing over time, but it is the kind of the collection of the mind towards this purpose. So these five qualities of concentration, each one of them directly counters a particular hindrance. So, and this is helpful for us in terms of knowing how to work with these hindrances at times. So this first one, the initial application of mind, that just directing the attention at something, that's set to counter sleepiness. So if you find yourself really sleepy, it can be helpful to just really focus on that. I'm just going to bring that attention to that first moment of the in-breath, you know, kind of really, really highlighting that connection with the in-breath. Just keep highlighting that connecting quality, that just bringing that mind back over and over again. The second, the sustained application of attention, is said to counter doubt. So this again is very helpful. What happens to us when we move into doubt is that our mind has left the practice. It started thinking about why this isn't going to work. It started thinking about what's wrong with these ideas. It started thinking about what's wrong with the teacher. So it's not anywhere in the vicinity of actually paying attention. And so the antidote or the counter, this quality of sustaining the attention counters doubt by bringing you back to the present moment and holding you there for a period so that the mind can't waver around in this area of doubt. So if you find yourself in doubt, pick anything and try to hold your attention on it for a time. And then you might find yourself a little more able to meet the underlying feelings that may be fueling the doubt. I found when I find myself in doubt, it's often not so much really about the ideas that are going on. It's about insecurity. It's about feeling of self-unworthiness, it's about fear, it's about many other things than what I'm actually thinking about. So if you can sustain your attention, you might get to see what's actually kind of fueling that doubt underneath. The quality of rapture, this delight and joy, it counters ill will. The quality of happiness counters restlessness and anxiety. And the quality of one-pointedness counters sense desire. So these hindrances fade with concentration, not only because we're letting go of them, but because these qualities of concentration are getting stronger. Now, the work with concentration does support this, the settling and the letting go of these hindrances, but it is temporary. That the state of concentration kind of puts those hindrances at bay for the time that the concentration is there. But those hindrances are ready to spring right back up as soon as that state of concentration falls apart. So this kind of the suppression of the hindrances, or the putting them at bay through the concentration, doesn't have the inherent capacity to uproot these hindrances or to take those patterns out of the mind. Wisdom is necessary for that, and I'm going to talk about how that works in a moment. So the quality of concentration, having this state of tranquility, of happiness, of kind of blissfulness, comes because the hindrances are suppressed, because the hindrances are at bay. The mind actually feels really, really good when these qualities of mind are not active. So the practice of concentration, when we get to this place of the hindrances being at bay and the mind being just able to be really steady with the object of attention, with the breath, at that point the mind is very collected, very unified, and is capable of moving into even more deeper states of concentration, into a mental absorption into the object that you're paying attention to. And I'm not going to talk too much about these absorption states, but I do need to touch on them because the classic textual definition of right concentration is defined through these four absorption states. So that's the classic definition in the suttas has to do with going into these states of deep concentration. As we settle into the object, the mind begins to recognize. So initially it moves into the object and just gets absorbed into the object, and that's when all five of those factors, the one-pointedness, the rapture, the happiness, the initial application of mind, and the sustaining, they're all very strong. And the mind can move right into that object. And then each of the successive levels of concentration have to do with beginning to recognize that even some of those factors of the concentration, the factors that put that concentration together, are a little bit agitating. So initially, that quality of bringing the mind and holding the mind, bringing the mind and holding the mind, that's a pretty gross aspect of the mind. And at some point, the concentration is strong enough to sustain itself without continuing to need to try to sustain it. So those two qualities fall away, and we're left with just happiness, rapture, and one-pointedness. That's a deeper level of absorption. And as the mind stays there for a while, it starts to see that the quality of rapture, that quality with a little bit of excitement almost, that's a little bit agitating. And then that falls away, and we're left with just happiness and one-pointedness, happiness and equanimity. And then the mind starts to see that even that happiness is just a little bit agitating and moves to just equanimity. Just the one-pointedness is the only factor that's left, and the quality that's left in the mind is complete balance of mind. So those are the four levels of absorption in this kind of focus on the concentration practice itself. Now I'm going to talk about the momentary concentration, and this is a different practice in a way. This is about bringing our attention not to one object, not settling our attention on just the breath and letting go of everything not the breath. Essentially, in this practice, the mindfulness comes to the fore, and we are cultivating the quality of sustaining mindfulness over time on changing experience. So it doesn't matter so much in this practice what is happening. It's just a matter of, can you stay present moment to moment for the flow of experience? The pressure, the sound, the vibration, the dryness, the heat, the coolness, the agitation, the calm, the quiet, the hearing, the pressure, just moment to moment, knowing what is happening. This takes a mind that knows really well what it means to be mindful and what it means for the mind to not be mindful, to really get very clear on knowing what mindfulness is, because it's so easy when we just open our awareness into the flow of experience to kind of drift off into some kind of vague, drifty state that's not really clearly present. So that in a way, this is a more challenging kind of practice. We need to get really, really clear about what mindfulness is. So this kind of mindfulness, in a way, I mean, this kind of concentration, it develops in a kind of a slower way, in effect. You know, I look at the concentration practice, you know, what we're looking at is we want to settle the mind down. And you know, if you think of a jar that's got mud in it, that's all shaken up, you know, there's a couple of ways you can settle that jar down. You can put it in a centrifuge machine and spin it around, and the mud will settle out of it pretty quickly. That's kind of the way concentration works. You know, you're kind of doing something very active to try to settle out all the mud. With this mindfulness practice, with the momentary concentration, what we're doing instead is just taking that muddy water and putting it on the shelf. And we're watching the mud settle. So in the practice of mindfulness, the concentration develops through being able to be present for whatever is coming through. Those hindrances will also come through in the practice of awareness, in a mindfulness practice. But they are simply what's arising in the stream of our experience. And we just turn our attention to that. That's the next thing. Anger, that's the next thing. Desire, sleepiness, whatever it is. That's the next thing. There's just this flow of both mental and physical phenomenon, and we just stay connected with it. And in that staying connected, the hindrances, the muddy part, starts to settle out, and the clarity of the mind begins to become apparent, and these factors of concentration appear. The one-pointedness, the rapture, the happiness, the initial application and the sustaining, these the factors of concentration arise, the hindrances settle through this staying present moment to moment. So concentration itself is not the end all of the path. It's not really the end of the path. It's the last factor in the path. When we talk about the Eightfold Path, there's wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. So it sounds like in some way that it's the culmination of the path, but it's the culmination, those three, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, the development of the mind. The culmination of that is the ability of that mind to clearly see with wisdom the experience as it is. So when moment-to-moment concentration is established and the hindrances are not arising, the mind has the power to see into this flow of experience and really directly, without any reactivity to that changing flow of experience, really see impermanence, see how because everything is impermanence, it's not satisfactory, not a satisfactory place to hold on. Nothing in our experience last long enough to hold on to in order to be happy. And that it's kind of ephemeral. There's nothing really there in our experience. When we really see the flow of experience, we see everything is just a process of, it's just a process. There's no thing or entity there. There's just process happening. So the moment-to-moment concentration allows us to see into our experience and directly understand essentially why we suffer. Because we directly see this impermanence, we directly see the unsatisfactoriness, we directly see that there's nothing actually there to hold on to. No wonder we suffer. There's nothing there to hold on to when we're trying to hold on to it. Actually, we create what we try to hold on to. Our minds create what we try to hold on to. No wonder we suffer. So we directly see that in our, as a mind is, with the concentrated mind, we can directly see that. Now the absorption concentration results in very pleasant mind states, and it is not directly in and of itself conducive to wisdom. You can use that mind, though. The mind that becomes concentrated through that one-pointedness. In the first place, you gain wisdom as the process of the concentration happens. As you go into the concentration, as you practice the letting go of the hindrances, as you learn to see these factors of the concentration arising, you get a really good education in cause and effect, how mind states are put together, in particular, how a concentrated state of mind is put together. You really get to see what supports that and what gets in its way. So you get a really good education about cause and effect as that concentrated state comes together. And then as the concentration, as you move into the deeper states of concentration, the mind in that state is not so much looking at changing experience. In fact, it's the opposite. It has created an experience to stay stable with. But as you let go of that state of concentration, the power of that concentration can directly recognize, essentially what happens is that it directly recognizes the impermanent, unsatisfactory, and ephemeral nature of that state of concentration itself. So as the state of concentration falls apart, the concentration is strong enough to be able to actually watch how that state of concentration falls apart and directly can see, again, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and that there's nothing really there. So the directly seeing into those three aspects, the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, and essentially the process nature, that there's nothing really there. It's all just a flowing, changing process. Seeing into those three very clearly is what opens us up to wisdom. And in a sense, the wisdom is the culmination of the Eightfold Path, that the wise understanding and wise intention from the first two aspects of the Eightfold Path, we essentially come back and revisit them with a deeper understanding, with an actual experiential understanding of those truths, and not just an intellectual understanding. And I think I'll actually talk about that a little more next week, to kind of come full circle with what is this wisdom that we actually directly touch into. this understanding of impermanence, of suffering, and of not self. So we have a few minutes for any comments or questions. Yeah, Sophia.
So I'm trying to figure out if you're doing anapanasati, and then you're hearing something. I don't know. It's like it's not the same thing. Like if you're doing walking meditation, and then you're taking in. Well, like what Gil was saying, you just. You see whatever your awareness is offering, your presence. But when you're doing that, I guess that would be more the concentration.
Right.
Then I mean, it's like you're not supposed to like take it in that way. You're basically, maybe you have that more instead of like in the foreground, it has to be retreating into the background, and somehow you don't allow yourself to.
So what you're talking about basically is, again, these different practices of more concentration practice versus awareness practice.
Okay.
And you can use the breathing as a foundation for a mindfulness practice, and you can use the breathing as a foundation for a concentration practice. So, it's kind of a matter of the intention going into the practice. Do you want to be cultivating the kind of one-pointed concentration where the mind settles and stabilizes perhaps more quickly? If that's how you're practicing, then when a sound happens and you notice the mind is pulled to it, you let that go and come back to the breathing. So it's just that, it's like I said, it's breath and not breath. Let go of everything, not breath, and just keep coming back. Just let go, let go, let go, let go.
Are you making a mental note that it's not breath, or not?
You don't have to. You don't have to. You can just mental note. You don't need to do mental noting.
No.
So with the mindfulness practice, if the focus of your practice is on cultivating this continuity of mindfulness. Then staying with the breath, and then you notice that the mind has been pulled off to the sound of the motorcycle going by. You don't need to ignore it and come back to the breath. You just pay attention to the sound of the motorcycle until it disappears.
Right.
And then maybe there's something else that's come up, or maybe there's nothing particularly compelling, and you can come back to the breath. So the practice that we teach here of settling and stabilizing with the breath is kind of a hybrid in a way. It allows you to settle the mind down with an anchor for the attention, but you don't have to stay tied to it when something else comes along. But then when that thing fades, then using the breath again to cultivate that stability of mindfulness. So when the mindfulness, if you're doing a pure mindfulness practice, you don't even hold on to an anchor of the breath. You just allow yourself to be in the flow of whatever is obvious. And sometimes that might be the breath, sometimes it might be pressure, sometimes it might be tension. So it's just like just being in the flow of ever-changing experience.
Okay, so repeat again. What were the two different distinctive things? One is the concentration, one-pointed, where you're just focusing on the breath primarily, and then everything, you're just letting it go to the foreground. And then if you want to cultivate just the more expansive awareness, then you're walking around and you're just allowing your awareness to present to your...
Right. In a sense, the second kind is that you're kind of following what the awareness is connecting with. Yeah.
And they're both helpful and they're both necessary on the path.
They are. And that's all the time we have. So I'll see you next week.